Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Take a look out at the bay, and you'll see a lineup of container ships waiting to dock in Oakland. But that's nothing compared to the dozens of ships waiting along the Southern California coast. The most important trade routes in the world, from Asia to California, cannot keep up with the demand for imported stuff in the U.S. Companies built finely tuned operations based on the assumption of just-in-time shipping. But the pandemic has kinked the supply chains, leading to long backups, odd shortages, and a reevaluation of global systems. We'll be talking logistics, the circulation of stuff, and whether this is really how we want our economy to work. That's all next on Forum, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Anyone who knows me knows that I may love logistics too much. Containers, dock workers, ship captains, distant manufacturers, the warehouses close to the shore and far inland, the poor drayage truckers. Nothing gets to the heart of how modern capitalism really works faster than looking at how stuff moves from some factory in Asia to some aisle of Target. According to the Journal of Commerce, the top five importers by volume, that's Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Ashley Furniture, brought in more than 2.7 million 20-foot containers worth of stuff last year, and that's just a tenth of the total. So much, almost everything in one way or another, is dependent on shipping. And for years, it didn't cost very much, and the flow back and forth across the Pacific was smooth. But then the pandemic hit. Everything went haywire all over the supply networks. COVID hobbled factories in Vietnam, can't make enough sweatshirts. There aren't enough spots on the docks. Warehouse workers are in short supply. Truckers can't be found. Even the actual steel containers, the boxes, can be hard to procure. The previously routine operation of getting something made elsewhere and shipped to a warehouse in the U.S. has suddenly become an ordeal. And that is why some people are saying you should buy your Christmas presents now. So today, we're going to untangle how the global system works and all the little ways it's affecting people's lives here in the Bay Area. Joining us are Jennifer Smith, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal who covers logistics and supply chains for the newspaper. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me, Alexis.
We also have Mario Cordero, the executive director of the Port of Long Beach. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we have John McLaurin, the president of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, which is a trade group representing terminal operators and shippers and focusing on global trade. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Alexis.
So, Jennifer, let's start with you. People may have heard about these ships stacking up outside ports in California. And so just to set the table for us at a high level, what economic forces are causing the problems right now?
Well, I'll try and avoid using the phrase the perfect storm because it gets thrown about a lot with this. Basically, since the pandemic hit back in early 2020, there's been a cascade of supply chain disruptions and demand shocks, miscalculations, and issues with shipping and labor capacity. And at the same time, here in the US, you had consumer demand that actually held up pretty strongly, despite all of the turmoil during the pandemic. So that's all added up to this flood of imports heading for the main U.S. gateway for Asian trade, which is the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. And that all those boxes are stacking up, there's not enough labor or capacity in various ways to move it on out, as you said. So that's sort of where we're at right now.
Yeah. John, you know, it's not really just about the ports, right? They're sort of every link is sort of experiencing a lot of stress in the supply chain right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, in August of last year, I participated in a discussion with the ports of LA and Long Beach and others in the supply chain. And the problem at that time was described as the following by a person who moves goods in that when they've got product in China, but they can't get a box. When they get a box, they can't get a ship. When they get a ship, they can't get a berth. When they get a berth, they can't get a truck. When they get a truck, they can't get a chassis. And when they get a chassis, they can't find a warehouse to take it to.
Yeah. I mean, what are retailers kind of doing to combat these problems? Are they increasing their inventory levels, Jennifer?
Well, part of what retailers are doing may be adding to the problem in the short term. Because of all these delays, some retailers, including Walmart and Costco, Home Depot, the ones with the deepest pockets, they're trying to circumvent the bottlenecks. Some are chartering ships to help move goods. They're laying in extra inventory. But of course, if they're moving in extra inventory, that's going to end up piling up at the ports in one fashion or another, no matter where it ends up landing. And of course, the Southern California ports are where a lot of these things do go, even though some people are choosing alternate destinations for the goods. But so the strategy is in some ways adding to the strain currently.
Mario Cordero, executive director with the Port of Long Beach. When we look at this surge of imports, like, what are we talking? Like, how many extra ships want to dock in your port? How many extra containers like need to be unloaded?
Well, and you know, like Jennifer referenced, it is a perfect storm, to use the cliche. So with regard to the vessels right now, what we're seeing here is there's, as of yesterday, 62 vessels at anchor waiting to get into the Port of Long Beach and the Port of Los Angeles. So the volume that we're talking about that's forecasted now for 2021 is 20 million TEU containers here in Southern California that are going to come
TEU
in.
TEU means 20-foot equivalent. I mean, most containers aren't 20 feet anymore, but this is sort of the standard measure in the industry.
Correct. So between Long Beach and Los Angeles, that's the number that is forecasted now, given the volume. Now, to put that into context, there is no other gateway in the United States that even approximates half that number. Wow. So it gives you the significance of what this port gateway means to the United States. And as was referenced, you know, the gateway that closely approximates the most important trade route in the United States or for the United States, which is the Trans-Pacific trade route with Asia.
So, you know, just very recently, just a few years ago, the Panama Canal was widened. And, you know, down, at least my understanding was down in Southern California, there was some worry that more traffic would go through the Panama Canal to the Gulf and East Coast ports. Mario Cordero, why aren't more places just taking that route instead of stacking up outside L.A. Long Beach?
Well, there is opportunities there with regard to the Panama Canal to go to the Gulf and East Coast. However, here at the Port of Long Beach, we were ready for the future 10 years ago when we invested $4 billion in capital improvement projects to be big ship ready. And the answer to your question is because at the Panama Canal, if you have a 20,000 TEU vessel, it's not going to go through the canal. So these larger vessels, what we call mega container vessels that are coming from Asia, are coming here to the West Coast, not through the Panama Canal. So we do have that advantage here, given not only the volume that comes in here, the capacity that we are able to move here. And last comment, keep in mind that during this pandemic and this epic surge, the men and women here at the docks have consistently worked day in, day out, moving this cargo since the spring of 2020, when we started experiencing the radical disruption in supply chain, given not only the trade war before that period, but of course now with the pandemic.
Jennifer, do you think that our current shipping system, which, as Mario noted, is so dependent on LA Long Beach, has it gotten too centralized?
Well, some people like to contrast what's happening at the biggest U.S. gateways with other ports in other parts of the world in Europe or Asia that operate on a 24/7 basis. That can be a little bit complicated, particularly to the Southern California port complex is surrounded by communities, and they have had to deal a lot with truck traffic, pollution from the vessels, and there's not unlimited space to expand. So that's only one of the sort of constraints. And Mario, I'm sure, could talk a little bit more about this. The Port of Long Beach is doing a pilot program extending some hours, but there's not been a lot of traction in terms of drivers coming in the dead of night to pick up boxes as of yet, even though it's extended. So you have to have to have a 24/7 port would involve having all the other parts of the supply chain operate 24/7. And that's a bit of an ask, particularly at a point where blue collar labor is in short supply. So there's difficulty getting enough truck drivers, there's difficulty getting enough dock workers to load and unload freight. And when I say dock workers, I mean workers at the docks, of loading docks, of warehouses. So these are all factors that are making it more complicated. And, you know, can you staff a warehouse to be open 24 hours a day? It's not as simple as just flipping a switch.
Yeah. I mean, John, as Jennifer was noting, it's really this kind of ecosystem of all these different companies that, you know, when each ship comes in, have to go to work. And, you know, I'm curious, you represent people who run tugboats and suppliers and things like that. What's going on with them? Because I can imagine that having way, way, way more ships at anchor is also creating some issues in that part of the ecosystem.
Yeah, everybody's hard at work. I will reiterate, I think, what Mario said earlier. I think one of the untold stories is that in the pandemic, in the course of the pandemic, we've moved an awful lot of freight under dangerous conditions where people just showing up at work were putting their health and lives at risk. And we've been moving record amounts of cargo. The problem is the entire supply chain is just swamped, and we're basically drowning in imports at this point in time.
I mean, how much, can you give us a sense of how, what the increase in imports really looks like? But quantitatively?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't have the figures off the top of my head. Mario's probably got a better handle on that than I do.
Yeah, sure. Mario, go ahead.
Yeah, so for the first 6 months of 2021, here in at the Port of Long Beach in Southern California, we had a 30% increase in container movement here. Now, keep in mind, the first half of 2020 was disaster because the world came to a halt with regard to the COVID-19 pandemic. But going forward, you know, we also have to understand California is the fifth largest economy in the world. And one of the reasons we are with a $3.1 trillion GDP is because of international trade. So this number of 20 million just in Southern California is not going to get any less going forward, whether we're in crisis or not in a crisis. So I think what this is basically, and again, using another cliche, crisis brings opportunities. There's an opportunity now for us to really seriously think of systemic changes that needs to happen in the supply chain. And as Jennifer referenced, it's not easy. It's going to take everybody coming together and collaborating. But the good news is we're seeing that at this point.
We're talking about backups in the global supply chain with Jennifer Smith, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal who covers logistics, John McLaurin, president of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, a not-for-profit trade association focused on global trade, and Mario Cordero, executive director of the Port of Long Beach. Mario, I know you got to get back to work, so thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for coming on. We also want to hear from you. How are you seeing these shipping problems pop up in your everyday life? Have you had to experience a long wait for a particular product? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is Forum. Stay tuned.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about backups in the global supply chain with John McLaurin, president of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, which represents a lot of terminal operators and shippers, Jennifer Smith, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal who covers logistics, and we'd like to add Charmaine Chua, associate professor of global studies at UC Santa Barbara. She's also the author of Logistics Leviathan, Circulation Empire, and the Trans-Pacific Supply Chain. Welcome to the show, Charmaine.
Good to speak with you, Alexis.
Yeah, good to talk with you again. So I know you've been listening. Do you think that COVID is pointing out anything that needs to change systemically about our global supply chain networks?
I absolutely do. So I think what COVID is revealing is vulnerabilities that long pre-existed COVID itself. The global supply chain has been built at least since the 1970s on what has been known as lean manufacturing strategies. That is, that typically involve minimizing the amount of inventory that's held in your global supply chains so that you are only delivered exactly what you need at the exact right time, as well as just-in-time delivery. And together, these have led to companies being able to produce their goods at much lower costs. It's allowed companies to maximize their profits. But in the process, what it's really built is a supply chain that's incredibly brittle, even as it's incredibly flexible. What that means is it's been stretched out so much that as soon as a disruption happens in one point of it, it's really a kind of cascading game of whack-a-mole, as Jennifer and Mario and John had already pointed out.
Mm-hmm. And Jennifer, do you see companies really rethinking this? I mean, this could be anything from, you know, reshoring in the U.S. their manufacturing, or just like changing their supply chain networks.
So companies are definitely taking a hard look at supply chain networks right now. That doesn't mean that you're going to see a wholesale return of manufacturing of all sorts of products to the U.S. That's very expensive. We may not have enough labor or other resources to do that. But this has really deepened a trend that was already happening as companies were taking steps to try and diversify where they're making stuff for various reasons. The cost of labor in China had been going up over the last couple of years. So folks are already looking to spread stuff to other lower cost areas. Then when you have natural disasters, pandemics, that just really reinforces how folks need not just one or two suppliers, but backups for their backups. And that's something that is being looked at pretty hard. And nearshoring is also something that you can probably expect to see more of as folks maybe look to be a little less reliant solely on Asia. Maybe they'll look for labor or factories in other parts of the world.
Does that mean like Central America or Mexico? Yeah.
Right. You know, where you already have, the auto industry famously has a lot of their supply chains are sort of run in between the U.S. and Mexico, thread pretty strongly, and you might see, you know, apparel or some other industries locating in other places in Central or South America, if that seems to be a way to hedge against some of the disruptions, so you just don't have so much concentrated in one part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I mean, you know, the answer I think that people think to this problem is to, like, quote unquote, like, buy local. Like, that just it makes so much sense to people. Like, oh, well, if I don't want to participate in these global supply chains, I could just, like, buy local. Does that actually fix the problems that you're seeing in the system?
That's a great question, Alexis. I do find that most of us, when we think about how to solve this, we say, well, I'll just change my consumption patterns. I think we miss the forest for the trees if we think only about what we can do as individuals. The problem with the stretch and the reach of this global supply chain and its reliance on cheap labor is that even if that cheap labor moves from China to Mexico or other low-cost areas, what we need to center is the fact that the system of this maximization of profit, our reliance on cheap goods, will continue to exploit large swaths of the global south and large swaths of workers. So I think really the question needs to shift away from what does local or more conscious consumption, perhaps we might buy less plastic, or we might, you know, buy less toys, that really is only symptomatic of a much larger issue. And I think we need to both be thinking about the scale at which we have come to rely on massive consumption and a massive extraction and exploitation of nature. And we also need to think about the ways in which this global system just can't be entangled more. And finally, I think we also need to be thinking about collective solutions to thinking and rethinking our reliance on supply chains.
Yeah. I'd like to add some callers into the show who I think are having all kinds of thoughts about these issues. Morgan from Sacramento, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What are you thinking about these issues, Morgan?
So I would have to disagree with the statement that one customer shouldn't be thinking about buying local. I changed my consumption habits over the past year, and I exclusively buy USA-made items, and it is a challenge. I agree that, you know, one person, what does that really matter in this? But in terms of, it does make a difference, and policies do need to change around that, and even from information of where is this item coming from. We don't need kiwis, or we don't need toilet paper coming from across the world. It can come from right here. And that why the ship ports wouldn't be busy. You know, we have people who need work here. We can make the products here.
Hey, Morgan, what drove you to want to change your consumption habits like that and buy locally?
It was really the pandemic, seeing the local businesses hurt, out of business, while the Walmarts of the world, you know, that's where everybody shops. That doesn't bring anything back to our local communities. It doesn't bring jobs. And I saw that firsthand. My family's been doing it forever. And I, you know, was Amazon's number one customer. I changed that because I wanted to make a difference.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Sure. I mean, you know, one thing that Morgan mentioned, which I think is really interesting, is how difficult it actually is to know what's like sort of made in the USA, particularly because these supply chains are so big. So even if it's like assembled in the US, it may have components from elsewhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate Morgan's point. I do think that, you know, one consumer making different choices makes a huge difference. But what I'm really pointing to is that we have to think about this collectively as a society, right? The idea that big businesses can ever localize is really tricky. It took China over 20 years to build a local base that supplies the vast majority of electrical components, chemicals, drug ingredients. The fact or the idea that we could only buy completely locally within the US, I think is not quite accurate. It's certainly true for a mass amount of consumption and commodity products, but it's not true for medical supplies, for touchscreens, for iPhones, so on and so forth. So unless you retreat to the forest, I think that we need to talk about the collective picture of what that global supply chain really looks like.
Yeah. Let's bring in Molly from Half Moon Bay. Welcome to the show, Molly.
Hi, thanks so much.
Hi, tell us your story.
So I work at the Bay Area's number one run specialty store, A Runner's Mind, and we've been told by different brand representatives that for the next 6 or 7 months, it's just going to be slow to get different shoes into the store. And so we've in turn been telling customers, like, if you really like this shoe, you should buy two now because we're not sure when we're going to have your size back in stock.
Thank you for that, Molly. I've actually encountered this very problem myself. John McLaurin, president of Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, I want to know, you have a lot of visibility into the industry. What about you? Are you stocking up on things? Are you thinking about changing the way that you're buying things in response to these supply chain problems?
Well, Alexis, it's funny you mentioned that. I did go to a local hardware store to buy something this weekend, and they were completely out of stock. Mm-hmm. So, and they didn't have any idea when it might be in. So, you know, I think this is an issue that's going to really affect touch just about everybody's lives here in this country. And quite frankly, it's an issue around the world as well. Mm-hmm.
And are you, you know, like, let's say we've got the holidays coming up. As someone who knows kind of what's happening, are you like, I'm going to buy presents now? Which I have heard some people doing that.
In our family, we believe in just-in-time delivery, so we're still a ways off.
Got it. Let's go to Alex in Oakland. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hello, thank you.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, so not too dissimilar from what you guys are saying. I am a hairstylist, and there's been major disruptions in distribution for us, anything from hair color to hairstyling. And what I've been seeing is that things will go out of stock, and we're kind of desperate for it. So when it's back in stock, we buy it en masse so that we don't have that disruption in our providing our services again. And so then it puts it back out of stock again. And we're just having this like cyclical cycle of up and down.
So we're talking like combs, or we're like even the really basic stuff of hairstyling, like clips, or we're talking more like slightly more like, complex.
Yeah, like pomades or hairspray to hair dye, you know?
Huh. Wow, that's so... Have you ever seen this happen before in your career?
Not at this level, no, absolutely. I mean, and when we talk about basics, you know, there's very basic, just brown hair color running out, and we're having to get really creative to color people's hair.
Can't even imagine the desperation. We're talking about backups in the global supply chain with Charmaine Chua, an associate professor of global studies at UC Santa Barbara, Jennifer Smith, the Wall Street Journal reporter who covers logistics and supply chain, and John McLaurin, president of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association. We want to hear from you. How are you seeing these shipping problems pop up in your everyday life? We've already heard about running shoes and hair dye and stuff at the hardware store. Have you been unable to get an item that's normally available and it's now back-ordered? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And, of course, you can email your stories, your comments to forum@kqed.org. We want to add Jordan Holman to the conversation. Jordan is a reporter with Bloomberg News who covers the retail sector. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I know you've been working on stories about how retail is sort of responding. And the first thing I want to get to is whether there's a difference between your kind of mom and pop retailer and how like sort of big retailers are working on these problems.
For sure. So the large retailers, they have more levers that they can pull when it comes to trying to solve the issues with the supply chain, but they're not immune to it. Because it is a global supply chain, if there is a factory shutdown in Vietnam, they have to be aware of that. Or if there's the port congestion on the East Coast, maybe they have more, or in the West Coast, maybe they have more resources to move it to the East Coast, somewhere Savannah. But that's costly. And so some of the retailers, that's really hitting their bottom line. When it comes to mom and pop shops, they don't have as much options to try to solve those problems this holiday season.
So for somebody who just, you know, you're one business owner and you have like one box of stuff in China, they're kind of in the worst of all possible situations. Yeah.
Yes. And I've heard from small business owners who said that they've been waiting for months, you know, to get a order of dolls. And that is maybe one of their key items that they're going to sell compared to a larger retailer. That's just a small category for them.
Yeah. Jordan, just before we move on to some more calls, just wanted to ask, are there specific industries or, you know, products that seem like they're being hit particularly hard?
You know, when I talk to people in the industry about like which categories are most challenged, people will say it is across the board. But some things that have definitely stood out, and especially when we think about key items for the holiday, toys, that's challenged. Specifically, one retailer had mentioned they've had an issue getting Light Brights and Tinker Toys over here. And then disappointing for children, but then for parents and adults, furniture has been a huge issue with couches. So maybe like your actual couch will come, but this, it will be a separate box for the legs for the couch, which could be a weeks long issue. Bikes. And then also, even if you can get items, they might be more expensive this year when you think about TVs or clothes. So that's a concern as well.
Yeah. Well, and if you look at the list of the biggest importers, you'll notice there's actually a surprising amount of furniture stores on it, in part because the stuff they import is so big. Want to add John from Berkeley into the conversation. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I wish for me that the elective gifts and presents and food and things like that were the most important thing. But I'm a contractor in the East Bay, and I'm getting my suppliers and vendors are telling me I can get materials in February or March. Mm. And that's just not sustainable. I think we'll probably have to close. Wow. And I've been in business for over 50 years.
Wow. So what kind of supplies are we talking?
Not workable.
Yeah. Have you ever seen something like this?
No, I've never. In over 50 years, I have never seen anything like this. I mean, we went through a lumber market manipulation, I guess, is the most forgiving way to put it, where the price of a sheet of plywood went from $25 to $105, you know, over the course of a month or two. It's come back down, and there's some supply in lumber. But when you talk about things like rigid insulation, polyiso, cyanurate insulation, which is very commonly used, the chemicals that are in paints, for example, the ceramic coatings for granules on shingles, they're just not available. And so the production on these kinds of items, which are essential items fundamentally, are pretty severely affected. And I don't know how you plan, you know, a business which is fairly intense in terms of scheduling when you're getting products that are delayed by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. It started out where there were just limits on what you could get. Now it's that you just can't get.
Wow.
So,
John, I'm so
serious.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that that's going on with your business. And thanks for, like, just giving us that insight into some of those items you wouldn't, you know, I think a lot of us heard about the plywood problems or experienced it ourselves trying to do simple things. But those deeper components of what it is to do construction. I really, really appreciate that. Jennifer Smith, just wanted to go to you on one of the things that I think is coming out is that high-end goods or more expensive goods, people are willing to pay more for shipping. So some of these things like rigid insulation, maybe the people who manufacture that stuff aren't actually willing to pay for the shipping, given that it's not a super high-value item.
I couldn't say whether that is the case. I do know that with higher value goods, people that make things like washing machines are starting to emphasize more expensive models because they get a better profit margin and they're having to bear higher material and transport costs. I will say that what your last caller said jived with what we're hearing from a lot of folks in the building trades, you know, that it's not just plywood, it's all these other things and insulation is a big deal, and people are looking to try and substitute materials when they can, but it's tough, and that can sometimes change building specs. So that's, of course, happening when you're having a very hot housing market, and even if you're not buying a home, many people are trying to fix up their homes. This is something that's been happening in the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say to the contractor, I hear you, yet you sound, that sounds like a microcosm of a lot of things that we're hearing. But it is, Alexis, to your point, you know, there is a battle for limited space on ships. So the Walmarts of this world are going to win out over smaller companies that are moving less freight. And the ones that are willing to pay more to move freight are going to get priority.
Yeah. Luis writes some comments from listeners. The supply chain. Maybe this is why Trader Joe's keeps not having pepper. Honestly, it's possible. Sue writes, this is an excellent time to change our current way of doing things and to slow the increase of climate change. How does all this container movement contribute to carbon emissions and climate change? Let's slow it down, only buy items we need, and be patient to get items in months rather than days. We're going to talk about that when we get back from the break. I'm Alexis Madrigal. This is Forum. Stay tuned.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Welcome back to Forum. We're talking about backups in the global supply chain and possible changes to the system that brings you the everyday stuff of your life with Charmaine Chua, Assistant Professor of Global Studies at UC Santa Barbara. She's also the author of Logistics, Leviathan, Circulation Empire, and the Trans-Pacific Supply Chain. Jennifer Smith, reporter with The Wall Street Journal, who covers logistics and supply chain for the paper. John McLaurin, President of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, which represents marine terminals as well as shippers, and is a not-for-profit trade association focused on global trade. And we're also joined by Jordan Holman, reporter with Bloomberg News who covers the retail sector. Jordan, wanted to ask you a quick question before we let you go. Ray, one of our listeners, writes, I believe people are profiting by creating shortages. Having worked in distribution, I know that withholding product from the market can help drive up prices. Recent example, toilet paper crisis, mostly caused by hoarding and withholding product from the market. Are you hearing anything from your retail sources about people who are like, well, this distributor is, you know, making a killing because of these supply chain problems, or retail stores that expect to make more money because prices have gone up and supply is limited?
I'm not personally hearing that. I think one thing to consider is this supply chain challenge is happening right at the most crucial time for retailers. The fourth quarter, this holiday season, some retailers can bring in a quarter or a third of the revenue for the year. And so if they did that, that would be a very delicate balance because right now in the market, all that we're seeing is extreme consumer demand. People are willing to pay for things, but there might be a limit, and you don't, as a retailer, you don't want to push prices too high where people just withhold spending completely. Yeah. So that's a huge consideration that's being taken place right now.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jordan Holman, retail reporter with Bloomberg News. Thanks for joining us. I'd like to bring in Norman from Burlingame, who wants to remind us of the multimodal nature of our supply chain systems. Welcome to the show, Norman.
Yes, hello. I want to put in a good word about freight trains. As a retired freight train engineer on long runs, very heavy trains between Oakland and San Luis Obispo on their way to Los Angeles and Long Beach, and then coming back from San Luis Obispo to Oakland, back and forth for many years. And I'm surprised that your guests, as far as the supply chain, have not mentioned the importance of the old freight train. Nope. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Norman. It is a an excellent point. And Jennifer Smith, let's talk about the importance of trains, particularly coming out of L.A., Long Beach, and to, you know, point east.
Absolutely. And Norman, you're a man after my own heart. I hope you're reading our coverage. Freight is indeed a big piece. While it moves, freight rail moves about around 30% of the goods domestically. Most, about 70%, moves by truck. But one of the reasons that the ports of LA and Long Beach are a big deal is they have these rail connections. So you can load, you can take boxes, unload them at the port, and put them right on rail tracks and move them out. A lot of freight moves by something called intermodal, where you're moving much of a long journey by rail, and then the other ends are being handled by truck. Sometimes that's slower than truck, but it can also be cheaper. And the issue with rail right now is that they're also having capacity constraints, just as the truckers are. So, but it is indeed a really important part of getting goods from these gateways and distributing them throughout the country, getting them out to Chicago and to other points deeper into the U.S.
That's so interesting. A listener tweets just in terms of one of these small things. I see the impact of the shortages daily in the electronics business, but this week I'm trying to find urethane-based primer for the painters who are starting to paint our kitchen. Who knew urethane was on the shortage list? We'd love to hear about shortages you're seeing or shipping problems that are popping up in your everyday life. Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook too. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Charmaine Chua, we have a few different listeners who want to talk about environmental impacts and climate change and overconsumption by Americans, however they end up defining that. And I want to give you a chance, as someone who's thought a lot about these logistics systems, but from outside the industry, as someone who's sort of been a critic of the way that these logistical systems have developed, how would you like to see supply chains work, especially given the sort of labor issues involved in some countries, as well as, you know, the considerable climate impacts from all this goods movement?
I love that question, Alexis. And I think that we need to not only talk about the climate impacts of goods movement itself, but also what that has enabled in the grand scale of the move of these global supply chains. So actually, when you read the supply news, part of what's really amazing is that you see food shortages in Nigeria and Africa, you see an energy crisis in China, you see floods and droughts affecting different kinds of supply. And so when we think about the supply chain industry, you know, shipping technically contributes only 2-3% right now, forecasted for something like 10% in 2050, but it's really the knock-on effects of what that has enabled at a grand scale. So my short answer to this question of what an ideal supply chain would look like is quite simple. It's just one that's not based on a maximization of profit and one that's not based on a reliance on cheap labor and cheap nature. And it's one that is less invested in the idea of cheap goods for constant consumption. It's about really, I think, degrowth, which was a theory in the 1970s following French theorists like André Gors, who asked whether it might be possible to imagine a world that is not reliant on the constant manufacture of constant goods for constant consumption.
Herman Daly, an American economist, always had like a great question on this about, you know, that basically America's answer to the poor in the United States was let them eat growth. John McLaurin, right. I assume that you have a quite different answer to this question about sort of what the ideal supply chain would look like or supply networks would look like, given that you represent a lot of terminal operators and shippers. Do you think, though, that there also need to be systemic changes over the next decade?
Well, from an environmental standpoint, I would just add that from a terminal standpoint, the industry has been experimenting and looking at a lot of different types of technologies and looking at the use of hydrogen, battery electric, but it's clearly moving towards a zero emission environment sooner rather than later. And that's going to be throughout the supply chain as we see, again, the development of battery electric or hydrogen plus requirements that are already on the books and those that are being developed by regulators. In terms of the supply chain itself, you know, nobody thinks of the supply chain until there's a catastrophe. And I think this provides us an opportunity to look at our supply chain and look at it in a holistic way and try to bring about some change. You know, one thing that we've talked about my organization in the past is that currently we operate under a pull system to take cargo out of ports. And that's where somebody comes in and picks up the cargo and hauls it away, as opposed to a push system where we just push it off of the docks. Look at FedEx, look at UPS. Imagine if we as customers went to their facility to pick up our goods, as opposed to them coming out and telling us when it's going to be delivered. So I think we need to have those kinds of debates and really look at it in its totality in coming up with solutions.
That's really interesting. Don from Anaheim, California, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Alexis, for having me.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
So my name is Danyal Haidari. I work for Pacific Environment, which is an organization dedicated to serving communities of the Pacific Rim. And I'm really excited that you're talking about the climate impacts of the supply chain slowdown. I'm based in Southern California near the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, which are experiencing up to 60 cargo container ships idling off the shores. And on the theme of the excesses of profit maximization, these ships are emitting heavy fuel oil, which is one of the cheapest oils on the market, causing the communities of Wilmington, San Pedro, and West Long Beach to breathe in cancerous air pollutants, including nitrous oxide, sulfur oxide, and particulate matter. So I'm really excited to bring up the public health.
The local, yeah, pollution impact. Yeah, I mean, you know, here in the Bay Area, there's been groups like the West Oakland Environmental Impacts Project that have been working on these issues. And a lot of it has been the diesel here in the Bay from trucks. But there is, you know, as you referenced, these ships burn this fuel. And the thing I've always, the little nugget of information that I've always found so interesting about it is the fuel is a tough fuel to burn. So they actually have to heat it up because at room temperature, it's like closer to asphalt than it is to the gasoline that you put into your car. Jennifer Smith, when are you hearing about the environmental impacts from having so many cargo ships off the coast? And do we know if we've been able to measure that impact on air quality in the areas around the port communities of Southern California?
So that's not something that I myself have reported on, but I did hear from a resident in that area after we had a story about what's happening there, indicating that they believe emissions are up because of this flotilla that's anchored off the coast there. And to the point about the polluting that comes from big ships, container ships, there is a push to limit emissions that's happening in the maritime industry, but there's divides between, sometimes it's divided by richer or poorer countries about how fast they want to go, what types of fuel they want to switch to. These discussions are taking place, but it has been contentious. And I think even as recently as this year, I think John Kerry, the US climate envoy, was hoping that the industry would speed up their progress to zero emissions. So that's its goal, it's a target. How quickly it actually happens remains to be seen.
Yeah. I also just want to say that, you know, one of the complexities of like measuring the environmental impact here too is there are so many goods aboard these ships that I think by most of the calculations I've seen, they have less of a climate impact than if we were to truck things around. Of course, depending on the kind of truck, how far the truck had to go, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, ship to rail has oftentimes been considered slightly better environmentally than using a big semi-truck to take one box at a time. So it's I just want to note the complexity there. Noel from Carmel by the Sea, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Alexis. Yeah, I was just going to say, along with the construction, we've had a huge increase in home purchases with families kind of moving out of big cities, given their opportunity to work remotely. So as the owner of an interior design firm, we're obviously seeing a huge demand for our services and for furniture. Mm-hmm. But because of supply chain issues, you know, ranging from shortages of foam that gets put into the seats of chairs and sofas, to the increase in demand and challenges of logistics, we've just seen lead times for furniture, you know, go from a typical 6 to 8 weeks to 8 to 10 months.
Whoa.
So that's just been a challenge for our industry when we've, you know, when we're seeing this huge increase in demand, just having a really hard time getting product. And then
what's
we've
your response
seen our
to
vendors
that, Ben?
Have to implement. Well, it's just a lot of communication with our clients and trying to, you know, and trying to let them know that we've got to be patient and, you know, we're doing the best that we can and that our vendors are doing the best that they can. But we just have to be patient, which is, you know, which is a challenge when you don't have a sofa to sit on or a dining table to eat at. But yeah, and we've also seen our vendors have to implement, you know, mid-year price increases, which we don't typically see, but because of the shipping increases in pricing. So we've had to, you know, the vendors have passed those on to us, which in turn we've had to pass on to our clients. So yeah, there's just, you know, been a lot of disruption.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Jennifer Smith, one thing we haven't talked about is just really briefly, how much has the price of shipping a container from Asia to California gone up during this time?
I think the technical figure is a lot.
I thought it was like 4X or something.
I think it could be as much as that. I don't have those figures at my fingertips right now, but it has surged pretty dramatically and because of all the factors that we've discussed here. And so that's a factor. I did want to bring up one thing that the most recent caller, when she was talking about shortages, a thing to keep in mind is some of these shortages are not just because of transport, but they're because of COVID-related factory shutdowns in places outside the U.S. where there is a lot less access to vaccines. So the global nature of supply chains means that Nike has trouble when some of their factories in Vietnam have to shut down because of COVID cases. So even though here in the U.S. we're focused on consumer demand, and it would seem that as many U.S. citizens who want a vaccine can get one, the pandemic is playing out very differently in other parts of the world. And because we have global supply chains, we need to remember that. And that's one of the reasons for some of the difficulties in obtaining products that people are seeing.
That's such a good point. Sharon from Oakland, welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a conversation with somebody who works at U.S. Customs, and she said that part of the problem is because the United States doesn't export a lot of items overseas, we are more of an importing country. The container ships that are coming to the United States are not being shipped back empty. So we are sitting on a bunch of empty container ships here, and then the container ships that are, or the containers that are in the foreign ports are going up, you know, 10 times what they were prior to this supply chain disruption, the COVID and everything.
Sure. John McLaurin with the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association, maybe you could address this sort of about the balance of container supply and demand in the global system.
Yeah, you know, depending on who you talk to, we either don't ship enough empty containers back to the Far East or we ship too many. I think it's a function, and every ship that departs California is leaving full. And by that, I mean they're loaded with exports and empty containers to their maximum safety limits. Boxes are moving back and forth. Our members are also purchasing more containers. But I think this goes to the issue of this is a global problem, a global issue. Jennifer had it right in terms of some of the impacts of COVID. Ports have been shut down, factories shut down. I heard that Shanghai's got 145 ships at anchor offshore as of last week. So this isn't isolated just to California or to the United States. This is really happening all over the world and creating problems and shortages everywhere.
Yeah. Just wanted to list out a few of the different things that people have not been able to find that they have commented. Toilet paper, paper towels, Diet Coke in 16-ounce bottles, men's formal wear. We've also heard urethane. We've heard rigid insulation. This is, I think, just a way of thinking about how interconnected the global economy is and how difficult it can be to keep all of these stores supplied, given that there is, as Jennifer's noted, still a global pandemic. We've been talking about backups and shortages in the global supply chain with you, as well as with Jennifer Smith, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal who covers logistics and supply chain, Charmaine Chua, assistant professor of global studies at UC Santa Barbara, and John McLaurin, president of the Pacific Merchants Shipping Association, which represents marine terminals and is a not-for-profit trade association focused on global trade. I'm Alexis Madrigal. This has been Forum. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.